You're listening to Managing Leadership Anxiety, Yours and Theirs, a podcast offered in partnership with Missio Alliance. Each episode, we discuss internal and relational pressures, how they block effective leadership, and how we can move through them to a greater health. And now your host, Steve Cutts.
Welcome. Hey, this is episode 2 of us treating Ted Lasso. We're going to take a look at primarily season 3, but we'll also look back at some of the journey from the all 3 seasons. And technically a solo episode. Lisa, my wife, is with me here. And as we start, we're going to light a candle. I remember hearing once, I don't remember if it's true or where it's from, but it's always struck me that God's name sounds a lot like us breathing in and out, and that Jewish rabbis say that from a baby's first breath, they are calling on the name of the Lord, so to speak. That helps me when I think about a candle, especially when I think about a candle on an audio podcast. It may be for you who are listening that the more tangible thing that you can do as we light this candle is you can just pay more attention to your breath. One of the things we coach people to do is either slow your breathing down or take a more intentional than usual breath. And so as you breathe in and out, just the recognition and the joy that God is good. And Lisa, before we get to Ted Lasso, we've both had some life-giving activities today. I was down in Wheat Ridge buying some nice speakers for my office, which...
I kind of like your life-giving more than mine.
And I stumbled across... I got to the place too early. I was in the car and I just got there too fast. And so I thought, oh, I'll just go find a little piece of food. And I found this amazing bakery.
Oh my gosh, yes. The biscuits were out of this world.
It was very kind to bring some home.
Yes, thank you so much.
And they actually told me, and I said, how are your biscuits? And they basically said, if you haven't had our biscuits, you've not
had
biscuits.
You really haven't had them.
And then you got to have one.
With a little bit of honey. And yeah. It was, I would agree. I don't know that I've had biscuits before. Yeah.
Yeah,
it was
really
amazing.
Good.
Yeah, it was amazing. And then... for me, gardening is something that feels draining until I get in there and do it. And then there's something about the beauty that comes when you pull out the weeds and really connecting to me with God and what I'm anchored in and where my roots are shallow. And then I had my daughter helping me.
And
great conversation and good company. And I was like, oh, this day is good.
Beautiful day here in Colorado.
Yeah, so beautiful.
Yeah. I got Brody out this morning. He's on both of our life-giving lists.
Yeah.
Just a joy-giving dog. And then I had to pick up a car from the mechanic, and I think it's a 0.6 of a mile walk or something. So Brody got to come to the mechanic. Freaked him out, by the way. I haven't told you that. But walking by all the engine bays or the bays with all the tools,
oh, no.
He was really wigged out by
that.
He gets
so frightened by noise.
Yeah.
He took our dad rose bush prunings that have huge thorns in them in his mouth, running around with them. I don't know how he did that.
Right.
Mind-boggling. But he does like to prune.
We've also we have a robot vacuum.
Yes.
And named it Meryl Sweep this week, which is just a name I love.
Yeah. Well done.
Yeah, and Meryl Sweep. I'm really happy with that
yeah.
name.
Yeah, and then when you clean it out, you check her hair. Is that right?
I check her hair every morning before coffee.
Yeah.
She has hair. She has Birdie's hair in her.
Yeah, lovely.
So Meryl and
Good
I have
Meryl.
An enmeshed relationship in some ways. Yeah. Hey, while we're talking about not Ted Lasso, what do you think of my hair?
Yeah, it's really growing.
It's growing long.
Yeah, and getting a little bit wavy.
It's getting wavy and a bit unmanageable.
Yeah, you're feeling like you need some help, just like Meryl Streep's hair.
I feel like the sides are a bit poofy.
Okay. Yeah. It's constant, isn't it? You're never satisfied with your hair.
Yeah, if it's not one thing, it's another.
I know, all of us.
Okay, last week, what we really focused on with this Ted Lasso episode was how do you build healthy culture and how does transformation take a while? I have been really excited about today because, Lisa, you do so much work with attachment theory, which is a theory I'm very unfamiliar with. We had this great guest on the show, I think it was 3 weeks ago.
Yes.
Jesse Cruikshank.
Yes.
And she's actually written a discipleship book on with attachment theory.
Yes.
But this is work you use pretty much every day.
Yeah, I'm using this. Yeah. I use this in parenting. I use this with clients. I am reflecting on this in myself, use it in conflict.
I feel it with you. I feel like our bond has a lot of this stuff in it. So.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So what I thought we would do is let's assume that most of the audience doesn't know attachment theory, which really was me. I wouldn't be able to teach it, for example. Maybe we could just go through the four different attachment styles. And then we thought it would be really fun to sift some of the Ted Lasso characters through that.
Yeah.
And then after that, guys, we'll get into differentiation where I'll feel strong, because it's very hard for me to be on a podcast and not, you know, feel strong. So let's go. What's the first attachment style?
Yeah, well, first of all, if we look at what is an attachment bond is an emotional bond that is created between two people and honestly between you and God. So we want to leave room to be able to weave that in as well. Mm. But attachment is usually associated with an infant and a caregiver, and that when the infant is born, there's a caregiver that is helping the infant feel seen, soothed, safe, so that they can grow up to feel secure. Hmm. And all those four S's are from interpersonal neurobiology. So Dan Siegel does a lot of work with that. Kurt Thompson does a lot of work with that. And so the whole idea, really across the lifespan, but we usually think of it more with children, is that we have a safe base that has been provided for us with usually with a caregiver at first. And then when we feel strong enough, safe enough, we can go out and explore our world, meaning that we can try new things, take steps, learn to drive.
It's like we're safe enough to be brave and try something that's not safe.
Absolutely. Yeah. Get into a relationship, and whatever that is going to change throughout the human lifespan. And then we have a safe haven that we can come back to when we feel overwhelmed, when we have overstepped our bounds, when we've fallen and can't get back up. And we have somebody that we can come back to that is going to be there, see us, hear our emotions, help us organize them, help with reframing, you know, at times, so that we can make sense of it and go back out and go again.
Okay. So a child does this with a parent. You and I are now parents. I am famously 51 years old.
Yes.
Do I still need attachment?
You still need attachment. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, do you feel like you still need attachment?
I feel like I need it more than ever.
Yeah.
I feel like in my 20s, and it was because I, in some ways, was not attached.
Uh-huh.
I felt like, oh, I'm fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then the older I get, the more I'm like, man, do I need my people? I need you, my kids, my friendships have gotten much deeper since I've learned to need instead of be needed.
Yes.
Like to me, my way of not attaching, I think, was, well, I'm going to help others. But man, I feel like I need it very much.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So it happens all throughout the lifespan. Hmm. And it happens, it'll look different in partnership and marriage. It'll look different in friendship, but it's all there and impacts how we show up and what we think we need, which we'll get to probably more with differentiation as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, one of the phrases I've heard you use a number of times, which I really like, is secure enough. An attachment is secure enough. What's that?
So really, the first form of attachment it's called secure attachment. And I love to add the word enough because maybe it's because my Enneagram Wing 1 mind makes me think if we're secure, we're always secure. Mm. And not one of us is always going to be secure in how we see the world, nor in what we offer other people. And so I love that word enough because it gives us permission to be human, which is super important to remember as we look at this. So someone who is secure enough most likely had a caregiver who provided a safe enough base and a safe enough haven that they felt safe, seen, soothed, and therefore secure enough growing up. In fact, I remember from my years in grad school, they actually said a caregiver can provide a secure attachment 30% of the time, and that is typically enough.
So your average parent that feels guilty about the last time they raised their voice at their kids or something?
Yes, that if we're doing it one third of the time, typically that's going to be enough for people to get what they need.
So when our kids were younger, I was raised when I was young that whatever is going on in my life, someone has it worse or it's not that bad.
Yep.
Which is a very 1970s way of raising kids. Like my parents raised us the way you raised kids back then. But when our kids were younger, I watched you, like a kid would come in from the trampoline with a scraped knee and their knees bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
And my tendency was to inherit the way I was raised and say, oh, you're fine. It's not that bad. Get out there.
Yes.
But you would actually spend sometimes only like 30 seconds and say, oh, that must really hurt. Does that really? Oh, I'm so sorry. And you would like do this thing where they felt seen. And then sometimes they wouldn't even need a Band-Aid. They just needed to be seen.
Yeah. The whole idea is for kids to be able to realize on their own that they're okay to go back out again.
Right. But my way of saying you're okay is you're fine.
Yeah.
Whereas your way of saying it was, oh, that must really hurt. And then the kid is almost like, actually, it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And to be fair, I didn't do that all the time. But yes,
well,
I did
third,
some.
One
yes,
third, one of, the third time. Of the time. I think we're celebrating the one third. But I remember early in our parenting, I was thinking, oh no, we are going to raise pansies as kids.
Right.
But actually, we have raised these incredibly resilient kids through, and is that part of attachment theory?
It's totally part of attachment. And it's, and as we look at it, it's even like we desire our kids to be independent for sure. But raising kids who are independent means that we have to provide the scaffolding to help them get there. And, you know, I've both experienced where we just want them to feel independent in this right. situation because it feels so hard,
right.
you know? But yes, in the earlier years, we're helping them become independent by realizing, yes, it hurts and it's human. And I can cry and then I can go back out and I can play or do whatever it is.
Okay. All right. So that's secure attachment. There's three other types of attachment. And obviously it goes quite deep. Maybe just give us a taste of the next one.
Well, and what I'm going to say with secure too is that what does security and attachment look like? And some of these descriptions I've taken from Andy Kolber in her book, Trying Softer.
Amazing. And a podcast guest in the fall. We're very
excited.
Oh,
yeah, we're going to have her on. So I just want to give, you know, I've kind of taken things from a lot of different places, but some of these descriptions are from her book, and it's called Try Softer, A Fresh Approach to Move Us Out of Anxiety, Stress, and Survival Mode and Into a Life of Connection and Joy. So she really spends,
it's a good subtitle.
She's brilliant and goes through all kinds of examples. But someone who is securely attached is going to tend to be able to trust people more readily in a healthy way, is going to be able to know what they need in order to deal with their emotions and emotion regulation. So we'll be able to more readily be aware of when I'm getting flooded and do I need somebody else outside of me? Do I need to lean into God? Is this something that I can, this is happening and I can regulate myself? Usually in conflict, we'll have more of a sense of communication and understanding to be able to self-reflect so that whatever's going on can be communicated, you know? And they're usually fairly easy to connect with, you know, like not all the time, we'll add the word enough to all of this, but that's what an adult who has kind of a secure attachment might look like.
Okay.
In life and in growing up.
And then we have three, shall we call them insecure attachments?
So then we have three insecure attachments. And we're going to really spend more time on two than we are on the third. So one of them is called anxious ambivalent. And it is the one where it's kind of like, I'm okay if you're okay, I feel like is the overarching theme of it.
Like that I anxiously need you to calm down so I can calm down.
Yes, yes. And if there's tension going on, then oftentimes these are the people who fawn. Or can flee. They can do that too. But these are the people who are really first think, if anything's going on with you, it might be me.
It disrupts. Oh, it might be.
It might be me.
Like
so,
when you say it might be my fault, but it also might not be my fault, but my responsibility.
Yes. So these people are constantly checking within themselves to figure out what am I to blame for? What did I do wrong? To make sure that somebody else is okay and just needing to have that clear they are, you know, rather than trust the process.
I was not expecting to sit across from my wife and be learning about myself. So please continue.
Oh, me too. Yeah. Totally talking about
just
myself.
Just thinking back on lead pastoring and I'm mumbling.
Oh,
here.
It's okay. So hard. These people tend to desire a lot of validation and closeness. A big fear for people who show up as anxious ambivalent is a fear of abandonment and rejection. You know, emotional dysregulation can be something that is just paired with tension in relationship and conflict in relationship. It's just hard to settle yourself if you feel like there's anything going on there. And then with that can show up as needy Or, you know, one of the famous ones, I loved Annie Downs was talking about this on one of her episodes too. And for the people who are totally texting often on social media and it's a hot minute before you hear back, it's so hard right. in that space to wait. And we see this with our teens a lot, right?
They feel rude if they take a minute to get back to someone.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's this, there's an assumption that is something going on. Is there a breach in a relationship
yeah.
if we don't hear back right away, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, in some ways, I feel like we're kind of breeding this anxious ambivalence just with how social media is being done. But that's a whole nother topic.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So attachment style one is secure attachment or attachment enough. The second approach, it feels to me like what we would call in capable life enmeshment as a broad
yep.
category, but it's just more nuanced than that.
Yeah, but there's a scale of enmeshment. It's not that right. you're completely enmeshed. It's just that that's where you tend to go before you realize, ah, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah. Okay. So for those of you listening, that's called anxious ambivalent. Mm-hmm. And then the third one?
The third one is anxious avoidant, also can be called dismissive avoidant. But the avoidant is key. It's the whole idea that you really live life feeling like you don't need people.
Mm.
That being independent is valued above being in community.
Yeah.
A lot of times in childhood, people who are show up with this attachment were taught that they shouldn't feel the way they feel. So it's so if you have sad feelings or big feelings, that's not okay. Or we're often taught that you just need to be independent. You don't need to need us to help you figure things out. So a lot of these people can be go-getters
yeah.
and have figured out a ton of stuff. And yeah, it's interesting as I think through couples I've worked with too, you know, it's just, it's hard when that's how you've been raised, then to feel like you need to need somebody else is overwhelming.
We were talking about a Hollywood superstar last night. I won't name him because we don't know him and don't want to disrespect, but he's very successful. He does his own stunts but he's gone through 3 or 4 marriages and we were chatting about, man, I wonder if he's happy.
Right.
Like yes. he's so productive. He's so,
oh my gosh.
Like what he can
do. So many
do,
movies.
Yeah. But is he actually happy. Attached? Is he able to come home and be seen and see others? And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the difference between these two insecure attachment types is that the anxious ambivalent that we just talked about will tend to then blame themselves.
Right.
The anxious avoidant, I don't really need community as much and will cast blame on others.
You're the problem.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Yeah. I deal with some people who, when I teach anxiety stuff, this category of people would say, I'm not anxious. And I'm trying to say, you're so anxious, you can't get into it with us.
Yes.
It's like you have such a low tolerance for anxiety and difficulty that mm-hmm. you just disconnect altogether.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or sometimes, this may be over nuancing it, but sometimes if you give a pithy piece of advice to a very complex problem, would that be related to this or that's different?
That one could go either way, right? Because, yeah, it depends on what the motive is and what that means for connection. But the key one is this anxious avoidant also fears being engulfed by people or fears having death that people are going to overshadow them, right?
Yeah, okay.
Or feel smothered by people.
Yeah.
The other, the anxious ambivalent, fears being alone, fears being isolated.
That's really good.
Yeah.
That's really helpful.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get into the fourth one that we won't spend a lot of time with Ted Lasso, but let's talk the fourth.
Yeah, and the fourth one is disorganized. And this is a tough one because in childhood, usually the caregiver showed up at some times as close and nurturing, and then in other times, abusive or neglectful.
Right.
And so there is a real disorientation, confusion with what it looks like to be loved and to have an emotional bond and feel connected. And so people who grew up this way will find themselves craving closeness, and then as soon as somebody starts to come near, really pushing it away.
Mm.
Yeah, and so there's just a lot of pendulum swings with that personality, that attachment style as well.
And this is where it's really helpful in church leadership because I think when we are leading people in churches, we're not always aware of these attachment styles. Mm-hmm. And then we get very confused by these wild pendulum swings, just with some people. I'm not saying as a general rule, but you and I have both run into this.
Yes.
With these wild pendulum swings where it feels like we have more trust than we've earned.
Yes.
And then suddenly we're out and that's it. The door's closed.
Yes. Yes. And often when that happens, we're running, just rubbing up against somebody's trauma parts, right? And that's the response that we get, and man, it hurts.
So oftentimes a disorganized attachment is a form, is a result of trauma or harm.
Yes, or neglect.
Could it also be, like, there's a category of parent, I was just writing about this in the book I just turned in, they do harm, but they don't mean to do harm.
Yes.
So like an addict.
Yes.
They really love their kids, but their addiction does great harm, but they don't intend to harm, as opposed to a abuse where they intend to harm, mm-hmm. that would still cause potentially disorganized?
Potentially. I mean, with all of this, it's also just the way a child perceives it. You know,
meaning they make out of it.
Yeah, it's the meaning that is made out of it about who we are growing up. And so it's kind of like a great framework, and there's so much else that goes into it, so it can feel gray. Mm. So that's why we can't say, you know, all children who were abused are going to have disorganized attachment.
Yeah.
And it could be that there are other people in their life who have deeply poured in other ways. It could be that, they were also surrounded by a church body. You know what I mean? Mm. And so, it's not just black and white that if you were raised like this, this is what you're going to end up being like. And the beauty of all of this is we have healing in this all throughout our life. Mm. You know, when you're anxiously attached, either anxious ambivalent or anxious avoidant, being with somebody where you can build an emotional bond and have a secure attachment is going to impact how you show up in other situations and in other relationships as well. So it's so beautiful that it's you can move. It's,
Well, and I guess I'm thinking a couple of things. First of all, this is a very complex and deep theory, and we're covering it quickly in one episode. So that's good to keep in mind. But also what it makes me think of is the Old Testament vision of God as a mother hen,
mm-hmm.
like with her wings sweeping her chicks under her care, like they're out and lost and in trouble and she's gathering them.
Yes.
That's a wonderful secure attachment metaphor.
Yes.
Well, the other one that comes to mind is Jesus, you know, a bruised reed he will not break.
Yes.
Like he's a safe person to come to and... Okay. Yeah.
And what's interesting too is it goes both ways. I mean, I think attachment with God can bring so much healing in how we show up with other people. And also to realize that whatever our main attachment style is, and typically we will float between two, you know, that oftentimes is how we show up in our relationship with God as well. So it's just interesting to watch. Do I need God to be okay so that I can be okay?
Yeah.
You know, what assumptions am I placing on what God thinks of me?
Yeah.
One
of the things you say that I actually don't think is allowed to be said in church, honestly, is that sometimes you need to find home in a person before you can find home in God. I love that you say that, but it's not very popular to say in church. Like we always like, go to Jesus, but you actually say, wait just a minute. It could be that the way you've made meaning out of God is a great threat to you, and it could be that home for you is a person first.
Yes.
Say a bit more about that.
Well, and I mean, that just reminds me of Imago Dei, right? That we are made in the image of God. Mm. And as Christ followers, sometimes people are going to find, I don't want to be sacrilegious, but a healthy image of who God is by the way we care and love other people.
Attach to
they
other
will,
person.
Yeah, they'll attach there first and then be able to attach to God.
I love it.
Yeah.
Well, and a lot of the theme that we've been tackling and is in my book next year is, look, God's invisible. Mm-hmm. Humans are very tangible.
Mm-hmm.
And it is harder to attach to an invisible, intangible God.
It is.
Okay. Well, okay, let's do some Ted Lasso. So we just thought it would be helpful and fun to kick around a few Ted Lasso characters. Like last week, we're not going to be exhaustive.
Yeah.
But we thought, I'll name a character and you'll kind of give us a guideline of where you think they land, and we'll both kick around stories about them. So yep. Let's start with Ted.
Let's start with Ted. Yeah. I mean, and you and I are going back and forth with this. There are many ways where Ted shows up as securely attached. I mean, I would never go to coach a professional football, English football league, not knowing anything about their rules,
yeah.
You know, and he goes and the whole crowd, what were they calling him?
Oh, well, it's a highly rude word to say, but
don't say it.
For you, it's not rude because in America, but it's, the word is wanker,
yes.
But that's like the F word, really. Like,
yes.
We're now swearing on my podcast.
Here we go.
Yeah.
But there would be scenes where the whole stadium is screaming that at him, and he's like, I'm fine.
Yeah, it's his nickname. Yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't need their approval because he knows his value and what he's doing with this team, and he sticks to that, and that's what grounds him.
Well, and if we go back to season one, we see the dartboard scene, what I would rate as one of the finest television scenes in history. He's so attached that he's able to do that. But then when Rebecca needs forgiveness, how quickly instead of being hurt by her, he has empathy for her, moves toward her, forgives her. That was a still
powerful scene.
Yeah, poignant scene.
Yeah.
What about when he's not well? Where do you think he goes?
Yeah, so he tends to go to this anxious ambivalent where he is very afraid of abandonment. And of course, in this whole storyline, he's going through a separation and a divorce.
And an unknown.
He was blindsided by it in many ways, too. So we see the fear of abandonment, a fear of being on his own.
He was abandoned by his dad in some ways because his dad committed suicide.
Yes.
Had that kind of thing as a teen.
I'd forgotten about that. Yes. So he often doesn't put the boundaries in place or share how things have impacted him. Instead, it's like he's doing everything he can to help somebody else be okay at the cost of him.
Okay. Yeah. Let's talk Keeley. Keeley's been on an interesting journey because this season it felt to us that she kind of wrapped up in others, not just Jack, the investor lover, but also her employees. Mm-hmm. What does Keeley look like when she's secure enough or securely attached?
Yeah, humorous. She has a wicked sense of humor.
Yeah.
She knows how to ask for what she needs.
Yeah.
She goes to Rebecca a lot and asks her what she needs. Even when she was with Roy, she would.
And she's not needy.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, just stating it.
Yeah.
She's able to handle criticism and still show up. There's points where it's harder for her to let things roll off. And she's human, but she can.
Secure enough, out of three times.
Yep.
And then when she's not well.
Yeah, and then when she's not well, we see her really isolate and shrink back and merge.
She almost goes to both then.
Yeah, it is. And isolating and merging, which is an interesting dynamic.
Right, because sometimes Rebecca's like, where have you been? You just disappeared on me for a while. But then other times she is concerned about how she's coming across to others.
Yes.
So she's flip-flopping, which is really helpful to know that we probably all visit all of these.
Yeah. Yeah, we do.
Okay. So then that brings us to, well, you know what? Let's go into Higgins.
I love Higgins. You love him.
I love Higgins because I love that character, you know, Leslie Higgins. I think where I fell in love with Higgins is his phone rings. It's his wife. And it's the Rolling Stones song, She's a Rainbow, which is just a great love song. And you're like, okay, Higgins is not this suit-wearing square. He loves Rolling Stones. He's like a hippie. Plus, he's a jazz bass player.
Yes.
Which, by the way, for our listeners, in real life, the actor, jazz bass player. I think for me, Higgins is almost always securely attached. His kids love him.
Yes.
His wife adores him.
So he and his wife seem to have a very securely attached relationship.
Right, they're not enmeshed. They just enjoy each other.
Yes.
And then I think for me, season two, when he says, hey, come over for Christmas dinner. Last year, no one came or one person came. Of course, this year, everyone wants to be with Higgins.
The whole team. Yeah.
But in season one, I was curious what you thought. What is it when Rebecca has sort of blackmailed him? Because for those of you, just to remind you, this used to be Rupert's team, Rebecca's ex-husband's team. Higgins worked for Rupert, and Higgins would help Rupert sneak in his women without Rebecca seeing.
Yeah.
So Rebecca's kind of paying that back by making Higgins keep her secret. What's that?
Yeah, so it feels like in the workplace in season one that Higgins would show up as anxious, ambivalent. Mm-hmm. I'm okay if you're okay, and I'm not quite sure what you need me to do in order for you to be okay.
Going to diminish myself.
I'll diminish myself. I'll tiptoe around. You just felt a sense of eggshells when he walked around, and that they, you know, he and Rebecca had this dynamic and this cycle of she's going to put him down and he's going to act like a puppy dog and try to appease.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. What was I just thinking of it? Oh, it's gone out of my head. Might have to come back to it.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yep, it's gone.
But
okay.
We see him growing, and it'll be fun to talk about differentiation too, because that's a huge piece. But we see him grow into a more secure attachment, even between he and Rebecca, as the seasons grow. But as she gets healthier, his health also comes out, and so their communication changes. Yeah. He will assert his opinions. He will question her. And so it's just a beautiful process.
It is. To watch. And that helped me remember what I was thinking. I've always thought of Higgins as Nicodemus in the Bible.
Huh.
Nicodemus came to Jesus at night because he was a Pharisee. He didn't want his own people to know he was with Jesus. Mm. And Higgins joined the Diamond Dogs.
Yes,
very
all the
early,
Diamond Dogs. I very love early. That. Yeah.
And he's like, wait, this is the best thing. I want in on this. And yet he was still colluding with Rebecca.
Yes.
So I've named Higgins one of the earliest motivated change agents. He was one of the first to say, there's something about this guy, and I want to move toward him and figure it out. But of course, not at threat to
not
my
at
employment.
Threat. Yeah. And there's a different power dynamic too. Yep.
All right, let's go with Roy.
Oh, so Roy shows up in the beginning as anxious avoidant. He is all about not needing people.
Unless, if I may remind you, you're a middle-aged woman that does yoga. He used to go do yoga, but as a general rule, anxious avoidant.
Yeah, anxious avoidant, doesn't want to need people, certainly comes off as he doesn't need anyone, grunts.
Very gruff.
Right, gruff, his famous cussing, you know, with Roy, just to put people at an arm's length.
Yeah, put them on the back foot.
Yep. That very critical blame would be, you know, quick for Roy. But we see him become so tender and change throughout the three seasons, and especially as we talked about last week with his famous question is, can people change? Yeah. And so we see him slowly realizing his need and being able to name it and experience love. It's a beautiful process to watch that he was like mainly anxious avoidant. And then you see him go to some secure attachment and then sometimes a little bit of anxious ambivalent, you know, to where he needs things to be okay with somebody else so that he can be okay too. It's really interesting.
The things I love about Roy, he's such a gruff character. And, you know, his question, can people change? And then one of the final scenes of the whole show is he's walking into Dr. Sharon's office for counseling. It's beautiful. Yeah. But three things come to mind for me for Roy. I think sometimes, babe, there can be a tendency to say, when I'm healthy, I'll be a whole different kind of person, which is what a lot of us want to be.
Yes.
But you see Roy's gruffness and directness when he's securely attached in beautiful ways. So he's in the car with his niece in season two, and she's teaching him, and he's saying to her, I'm afraid that all you'll ever get from me is the worst parts of myself.
Yes. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. But then that same season, Rebecca goes out on a date. I don't remember, the guy was a dullard or something. And she says to Keely and Roy, what do you think of this guy? And Keely's like, he's fine. And then Roy very gruffly and bluntly says, you can do much better than just fine.
Yes.
So it's like all of that personality of being direct, blunt, and gruff, but there was this attachment, tenderness.
When you can use your gruffness and steward it for the purpose of bettering the relationship or somebody else for connection and better connection, it can be used.
Okay, Rebecca. What's Rebecca?
Similar to Roy, right? Like anxious avoidant, and we see her move and change, that she didn't want to need anybody, certainly after the pain and woundedness caused by Rupert and her marriage.
Yeah.
And when Ted wanted to connect and pursued and, you know, all
Biscuits
throughout
every
season
morning.
One. Yes. And she resisted and resisted and resisted.
It was such a bother to her.
Yes, such a bother. And it wasn't until, she caught up with her own pain that she was able to be vulnerable. And then we see this attachment bond form between Ted and Rebecca. And I feel like that was one of the most healing parts for her.
I agree.
Yeah.
And then season two, it's almost like she was surprised that everyone came to her dad's funeral.
Yes.
Like she's like, wow.
You care about me?
Right. Yes. And then by the end of season three, she's the team mum.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yes. Let's do a couple more. We were kicking around whether to talk about Jamie and Nate. I think we should go for it. So Nate is a complex one.
He is. I know. At one point we're wondering, man, is he disorganized? Because he is very much the come close, go away, come yeah. close, go away. But that can also look like some of your anxious attachments too. But he definitely nervously attached. He desired validation. He was afraid of abandonment and rejection. In fact, to the point of being bullied, because that was the way he was able to find connection in those earlier seasons.
Okay, say more about that. If someone is being bullied,
you're still getting attention.
Yeah.
You're still negatively, but part of the team.
I mean, it takes me right back to Las Vegas when we used to live and work in Las Vegas at a church, and the amount of people in domestic violence who just were convinced that that was like their role in life.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's how they saw themselves. They didn't see themselves as ever being able to be free or healthy. It's quite haunting.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So he then decides, well, I'm the, and this, you've kind of unlocked something here, because it's also a systems theory idea that his behavior is attracting bullies. He's not responsible for them being bullies, but he is attracting.
Yes.
It.
Yes. It's a vicious cycle, isn't it? Yeah, and he's, I don't know, I hesitate to do much with Nate because there's so much, it's fictional, right? So,
it's fictional. But what we can say is season three, he really was on a rich journey of secure attachment.
Very rich journey of secure attachment. And we see that with his dating relationship with Jade.
Yep.
We see that with his father and repair that was made when he learns, you know, how his father actually felt about him, that he was a genius, and his father admits, I didn't know how to parent you.
Yeah.
And that unlocked something in him.
He saw Rupert and like, I don't want to be anything like that guy.
Yes.
And then I love that the writers had him as the assistant to the kit man at the end.
Yes.
Because to me it was like, he so wanted to be somebody and he realized that attachment was getting to be part of this wonderful thing. There's been so many parallels for me. Like, obviously, this is a global podcast, but we're in Denver, and our precious basketball team, the Denver Nuggets, are really going for it, and they might win the championship, and we're all so excited.
Yes.
But there's so many parallels here that the way the Nuggets are being coached, there's really no superstars.
Right, yeah.
Even though we have what many say is the greatest player on the planet right now, Nikola Jokic, he doesn't believe he's a superstar. And everyone gets to play their part, and they're very happy just to be part of the team. That's
and
what
they're very happy to pass credit on to each other on the team. Yeah. Which is just, yeah, phenomenal.
Yeah, and so Nate just enjoying that he gets to be back in Richmond.
Yeah, which is a full circle for him, because he goes to wanting at some point, I feel like, yeah, he goes into this avoidant, it's all about me, blame others. I don't need anyone. I don't need anything except for my own success and prestige.
Yeah.
And to realizing that is not who I am, and coming back into these attachment bonds where he can feel safe and seen and soothed, and therefore secure.
Yeah.
Yep. Interesting.
There's so much, people have so much angst about Nate. And I just personally feel like they handled his character arc beautifully. Because I think people wanted him, they called him Evil Nate on social media all the time. And I just think they didn't understand what it's like for a marginalized person to finally get the shine of attention, but not get what he needed with
yes.
that shine. And like how
oh,
much.
Oh, say that again.
Yeah, not quite sure how to, but it's like Ted shone his warmth and love on Nate,
mm-hmm.
but Nate needed something more than Ted could give. Therefore, Ted was always letting him down. Or always minimizing and dismissing him.
Mm.
We covered this a little bit last week, like when Ted calls him by name, the first person to know his name, and Nate's like, me?
Yes.
And Ted's like, well, for the time being, when I say Nate, I mean you.
Yes.
And then the photo and all of that stuff. But really what was going on is Nate had a canyon-sized void in his life.
Yes.
And Ted's spotlight was a tiny little thing. It wasn't this healing thing. And so therefore Nate felt abandoned and set up to be let down and all of this. So I don't know. I have a lot of empathy.
A ton of empathy for Nate.
Yeah. Okay, let's do one more. Jamie Tart.
You go with Jamie. Yeah, he confuses me.
Oh, man. So,
and he's so fictional too, right? Like he is, yeah.
He's fictional. We mentioned last week, and I'll just say it again, we were losing our way a little bit watching season 3 in the middle mm-hmm. episodes. And we're like, we've kind of lost this show we love. But when we went back and started watching some season 1 episodes, we were blown away that Jamie was a whole transformed human. I don't want to say different human. He's still very Jamie. But okay, so I guess in season 1, I would say he was anxious avoidant. I'm looking at your words here.
Yeah, and then sometimes I wonder if they're just disorganized with Jamie too, because he had an abusive father.
Yeah, abusive father. He abused people on the team.
Yes,
he got pleasure out of their pain.
He did, right? He was the one who was the instigator with bullying Nate and ringleader and all of that.
He liked to objectify Keely. Like it was just her body and her sex. It wasn't who she was.
Yes, absolutely. And had so much need himself. Mm-hmm. So you see, we kind of do see in him the whole come close, go away, come close, go away, come close, go away.
That fits when he left for Man City and Ted wrote him that very kind note of mm-hmm. blessing. And he took it as a threat.
Yes.
That would be disorganized, I think, where he can't see reality.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, I'm sorry, but season 2, he's now on this terrible reality show, convinced he's going to be the winner. I believe the opening scene was him convinced he would win the prize only to be kicked off whatever the show.
Yeah, whatever it was. Yeah.
And then kicked off the team and suddenly discovering he's not really wanted.
Yeah.
I think his own agent basically said, look, you're an absolute drag to represent.
Yep.
Yeah.
We come back to the quote that we talked about from Kurt Thompson last week, right? That we all enter this world looking for someone who is looking for us. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that one really comes in the healing for Jamie, because when he allowed himself to believe, even in Ted's eyes, that Ted was looking for him.
Yeah.
You know, and he comes back to be a part of the team. And I feel like that became... he allowed for some healing and he received in that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we watched this whole dynamic between he and Roy change.
Oh, man.
And there is, it's like a father figure mentor, but then it's reciprocal. And they both end up forming this emotional bond where they deeply care for each other.
Right.
And tick each other off
fight
it out.
They're totally like brothers.
Just like brothers.
Oh, man.
So you see a lot of healing in him where I would not at the end classify him as a disorganized attachment style, that he has times of being insecure and he has some times of being secure too.
I thought the signs of him really being secure started in season 2, because I wondered, why did Ted invite him back on the team? It disrupted the team. Sam was very threatened by it. Mm-hmm. But very early on, Sam realizes this is a different Jamie. Sam wanted to boycott the team sponsor, mm-hmm. and Jamie was the first player to boycott with Sam.
Yes.
And that's when Sam's like, oh,
that's right.
This is a different Jamie.
Yes.
And then when Zavra showed up in season 3, Jamie is dismissing him. He's kind of in that anxious avoidant.
Yeah.
He's threatened by him. And then through his attachment to Roy, he's realizing, I can just be myself.
Yes. I don't have to be threatened by him. And
yeah, a beautiful, beautiful story, I think.
Yeah.
Beautiful journey.
Good stuff.
Okay. All right, folks. That's attachment theory. Through the lens of Ted Lasso, or it might be Ted Lasso through the lens of attachment theory. And after a little break, just a little musical break to let your brain rest, we'll dig into a bit of differentiation. All right, folks. Hey, just a reminder that Lisa and I are hosting a conference here in Colorado called Unlocking Faith, October 2nd through 4th. Not just us. We're also bringing Dr. Chuck DeGroat, Jill Phillips and Andy Gullahorn, Renee Loring and Jimmy Carnes. There'll be a number of speakers. And we're doing a very specific thing at this conference. If you struggle to experience the God you believe in, we want to try to help you with that, particularly as it relates to God's love, God's presence, the story you tell yourself, the way you treat yourself, the way you talk to yourself, and the way you see the world. I mean, these are big, broad topics. But what we want to do is help you locate some beliefs that are getting in the way of your true belief in Jesus. This is the work that we do in Capable Life. And we're not just going to use systems theory and attachment theory. We're also going to be showing some parts of self-work and some trauma work. It's going to be quite rich. So you've got some options. You can join us in person in Colorado. That's always fun. We've got a number of people flying in. But you can also join us online, live streaming, or if the schedule doesn't work, join us later on demand. Your live streaming ticket will give you access on demand as well. And then we have a number of organizations that are opening up their auditoriums, and they are hosting the conference in your state or your city around the world. So capablelife.me is where you go for tickets. Early bird rate and prices end June 30th. So now's the time to jump in. All right, babe. I just wanted to touch on, before we leave Ted Lasso, I wanted to have a little conversation about differentiation, because that was where my interest in Ted Lasso for this podcast, I mean, I just love the show, but for the podcast. And I'm running into more and more people who are, how would I say it? It's almost like they're wielding differentiation against others, or they are confusing boundary language with differentiation.
Yes.
So I wanted to get your take on that. Like, you even had a professor in grad school.
Yeah, I remember in grad school, we learned about differentiation, family systems, and attachment. And at the end, we had to write a paper where we were, using several theories and what we would use and integrate, right, and working with people. And I was trying to figure out how to use differentiation and attachment, and even had a professor said, don't try to combine them.
They're mutually exclusive.
They come from different places. Yeah. The motivation is different. Choose one.
Yeah.
And so then it's funny and I chose attachment, and then with you doing your work all about differentiation, like our parts have had to wrestle against each other, and we've had to do some figuring out of where does this align?
Right.
Where is it different? And for what purpose, right? For what purpose are we attaching, and what purpose are we differentiating?
Yeah. And I think what's interesting about differentiation is, you know, obviously it was first coined by Murray Bowen, a psychiatrist, 1950s and 60s. And then I think it's been made most famous by Edwin Friedman. Mm-hmm. And I wish I had met Dr. Friedman before he died. But as I read Friedman, and as I did chaplaincy with one of Friedman's friends, my assumption about Friedman is that he is on the coolest scale of relationships. He would tilt toward detached.
So if green is like enmeshed and warm, you know, and red is,
Or blue.
Or blue.
I'd say blue.
Blue is cold and, detached, that he would be more in the blue.
Yeah. And of course, what's interesting about this is I very much tilt toward enmeshment.
Yes.
Every, 9 out of 10 days. And the times I tend to detach is when I'm exhausted from enmeshing. That's usually what tends to happen.
Well, who needs it anyway?
Yeah. Yes. Like, I've had enough of people. Yep. But I think Friedman leans cool. And so therefore my take is that systems theory has tilted cool because he's our most famous teacher of it.
Yes.
And I can't tell if I am redeeming Bowen or just, making crap up myself.
And I would be, and I don't even know if it's allowed to say this, but I'd be so curious, was Friedman anxious avoidant?
Right. Went right.
Teaching differentiation. You know what I mean? Like, would be interesting.
My boss had a story. He was at a conference with Ed Friedman, and they're on a panel, and then it's question and answer time, and there's people in line and a microphone. And this lady was so anxious to get her question answered, she jumped the line.
Ooh.
And everyone in line allowed her. No problem, man. Obviously, you really want your question answered. And he would not answer her question. Ma'am, I don't tolerate rude behavior. You can wait your turn. And if we've run out of time, that's too bad.
Wow.
And then George said the whole room turned against Friedman.
Yes.
And he just kept defining himself one against the many. And that, to me, is the evidence that he moved more to anxious avoidant or detached.
Right. Rather than reading the room and connecting with the need in
Right. Yeah. Or yeah. Like I would say differentiation is the two things I wanted to focus on with Ted Lasso is step three, which is connected to myself and connected to you.
Mm-hmm.
And step four, defining myself. Mm-hmm. Those would be the two things I'm interested in with Lasso.
Mm-hmm.
Like, couldn't Friedman have said, I'm going to connect to you, ma'am. Obviously, you really want your question answered. I just want you to know now, you'll get it answered.
Yes.
Now, it may not be in the microphone. It may not be in front of everyone, but I'll stay around. Come up to me afterwards. Why don't you wait your turn? It's fine. That would, to me, that would have been differentiating. He would have held his ground. That he wasn't building a wall, he was moving toward her, in my imagination.
Well, and in attachment language, he would have, that would have caused her to have seen, been seen.
And
right?
She would have been soothed.
And soothed, like, my question will be answered. Yes.
I anxiously need to know. Okay, yeah. Well, you may not, and he might have even said, I may not have a good answer for your question,
yes.
But I will listen to you or whatever.
Yes.
So to me, what's fascinating about Ted Lasso is when we look at people's differentiation journeys, it's just another. Like the way I think about differentiation and an attachment, they're just two windows to climb into to get into the similar house or
yes.
Same house. So, okay, step three and four of differentiation. For those of you listening, you're like, especially those of you perfectionists who like to fill in the blanks, you're like, which is one and two? What's step one and two? Okay, step one is I'm going to stop trying to spread anxiety. I'm mm-hmm. going to manage myself from spreading it. And step two is I'm going to work on not catching anxiety. Very simple. So I'm going to make the commitment that I won't spread it as much as I can and I won't catch it from others. And to your rule, one out of three times
ain't bad.
Great, really great. Yeah. Okay, step three is where it gets really interesting. I'm going to work on attaching to you. I'm going to work on connecting to you.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also going to be connected to myself, mm-hmm. which for the anxious ambivalent is such a gift.
Yes, it is.
That for me was chaplaincy is like, oh man, if I'm going to help these people, I must be connected to myself.
Yes.
So that's step three. Step four is I will define myself. You won't define me.
Mm-hmm.
That is the step where people start bringing in boundaries language and building walls
mm-hmm.
instead of working on step three and four together.
Right.
And that's where I think Rebecca is just remarkable. Well, if mm-hmm. we go back to the scene with that African dictator wanting to form this rogue football club.
In the boardroom.
Mm-hmm. It's and then her connection to Rupert from then on
mm-hmm.
to me was three and four.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to work on connecting to you, but you will not change who I am. You can't hurt me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What's your take on that?
Oh, I mean, I think it's right on. And it's a beautiful example of how differentiation and attachment work together because yeah, by her being able to attach within herself to know truly who she was, what she thought, her own definition, and therefore what she needed and what she did not need allowed her to show up vulnerably and connect with boundaries.
That's what's so powerful about it is she's now free to attach,
yes.
Whereas before she couldn't. And then the last thing I want to do, because, you know, we could do another whole episode on Lasso and differentiation.
Yes.
And, hey, listeners, we have a couple more episodes this season. If you want to cry out, we will take a listen. Like
Lasso. Yes.
Yeah, like Pharaoh did in Egypt, we will hear your cries. So if you want another one, maybe we could dive deeper into this. But the last thing I want to end on today's episode is Ted and Rebecca, season finale, in the stands, just the two of them. And that brings us to step five of differentiation, which is your vision and values of who you are have to be connected to reality.
Yes.
You can't just be in your own reality connected to yourself. You have to actually be in reality. Rebecca desperately wants Ted to stay.
Mm-hmm.
He's changed her life. Him coming has made her life so well, and she sees the impact on how it's made so many people well. But he has to go home.
Because it's not his reality to be able to stay and be well.
He can't be well and stay. He has to go back and be a present dad.
Yes.
I think what he's doing is fighting for his marriage.
Yes.
We think a marriage that Michelle now wants.
We think. We're hoping.
Yeah.
I wish there'd been more on that.
But she's at least open to it.
Yes.
Because when that last game, when Dr. Jacobs, what was that guy's name?
Yeah, Dr. Jacob.
The therapist.
Yes.
That
the marriage therapist that helped them separate.
Yeah, the therapist that you love because he he crashed all boundaries and violated ethics.
Oh, gosh.
Violated ethics by dating his client. Like, you can see he is detached watching the game. He's making fun of the game. Mm-hmm. And you can see Henry and Michelle
teaming up against him.
Cutting off him.
Yes.
Right. So there's Ted. There's Rebecca saying, this is home. You can be home here. Mm-hmm. And he's very connected to her. He's very connected to himself.
And says nothing.
Yeah, we've mentioned that before. He's just so quiet.
He lets
why his, do you think he's not saying anything?
I think he says nothing because, well, another thing about attachment is just the mirror neurons, right? Where you can read another's body language, that you can see kind of almost into the gut to even behind what they're saying and the longing. And I feel like it just showed him the mirror neurons were just going back and forth to be able to read each other so that he didn't have to say anything. His presence and his non-anxious presence to be able to hear her and feel sad that he couldn't be in both places almost, that very much he would like to be able to fulfill that piece of home. And he has another home he has to go to. His silence and care, not withdrawing at all, but silence and care and just allowing it all to be held. She knew it. She just needed to process through it to be able to say it and name it.
And she even said, I think, I know what's going to happen next is you're going to tell me tomorrow.
Yes.
And then she says something like, actually, you don't need to wait, do you? And that's where he either nodded or spoke up. I don't remember. But he at least affirmed,
yes,
I'm heading home.
Yes.
Oh, it's beautiful. So interesting. It's another thing I've learned from you is when somebody wants something they can't have, I get angry at them. Whereas you are really good at saying, oh, I wish you could get that, but you can't. Like, that is another form of what we would call differentiation. Mm-hmm. Like, that's kind of what he was doing, is that, oh, Rebecca, I wish you could get what you want right now.
Yes.
I can't give you what you want. Whereas I would get defensive, I think, and say, I can't be in two places. I want, you're forcing me to choose. There'd be this like anger.
You're considering your needs, but not mine.
Something, or can't you see I have to go be, but instead, a truly attached person or differentiated person in our definition is able to mourn with somebody who wants something that they can't have.
Yeah.
And it's because I want to give people what they want.
Oh, and
so when
like
I can't give them what they want, I feel like a failure. Aww. Therefore, I have to cut them off. I know, I need a hug. Yeah. Okay, folks, this was a one-hour episode. Super fun, babe. Thank you so much.
So interesting. I feel like I learned stuff as we went through this. Yeah.
I do have a plan for our next week's episode. I've got a little agenda for it. And if our audience cries out, we'll see if we can squeeze another episode out of Ted. Otherwise, join us next week for our pre-planned agenda.
For more resources, visit stevecusswords.com or missyoualliance.org.